be home long enough to grab a bite to eat and walk his dogs. Calvo worked full-time at an educational foundation in Washington, D.C., but he also had an unusual part-time job. He was mayor of the small town of Berwyn Heights, Maryland. In 2004, at age 33, he was the youngest elected mayor in the history of Prince George's County, Maryland. Now 37, he lived with his wife, Trinity Tomsic, her mother, Georgia Porter, and their two black Labradors, Peyton and Chase. Calvo was due back in town later that night for a community meeting. As Calvo took the dogs out for a walk the evening of July 29, 2008, his mother-in-law told him that a package had been delivered a few minutes earlier. He figured it was something he had ordered for his garden. "On the walk, I noticed a few black SUVs in the neighborhood, but thought little of it except to wave to the drivers," he would later recall. When Calvo and the dogs returned, he picked up the package, brought it inside, then went upstairs to change for his meeting. The next thing Calvo remembers is the sound of his mother-in-law screaming. He ran to the window and saw heavily armed men clad in black rushing his front door. Next came the explosion. He'd later learned that this was when the police blew open his front door. Then there was gunfire, then boots stomping the floor, then more gunfire. Calvo, still in his boxers, screamed, "I'm upstairs, please don't shoot." He was instructed to walk downstairs with his hands in the air, the muzzles of two guns pointed directly at him. He still didn't know it was the police. He described what happened next at a Cato Institute forum 6 weeks later. "At the bottom of the stairs, they bound my hands, pulled me across the living room, and forced me to kneel on the floor in front of my broken door. I thought it was a home invasion. I was fearful that I was about to be executed." I later asked Calvo what might have happened if he'd had a gun in his home for self-defense. His answer, "I'd be dead." In another interview, he would add, "The worst thing I could have done was defend my home." Calvo's mother-in-law was face down on the kitchen floor, the tomato artichoke sauce she was preparing still sitting on the stove. Her first scream came when one of the SWAT officers pointed his gun at her from the other side of the window. The police department would later argue that her scream gave them the authority to enter the home without knocking, announcing themselves, and waiting for someone to let them in. Rather than obeying the SWAT team demands to get down as they rushed in, Georgia Porter simply froze with fear. They pried the spoon from her hand, put a gun to her head, and shoved her to the floor. They asked, "Where are they? Where are they?" She had no idea what they were talking about. She told them to look in the basement. She would later tell the Washington Post, "If somebody puts a gun to your head and asks you a question, you better come up with an answer. Then I shut my eyes. Oh, God, I thought they were going to shoot me next." Calvo's dogs, Peyton and Chase, were dead by the time Calvo was escorted to the kitchen. Peyton had been shot in the face almost as soon as the police entered the home. One bullet went all the way through him and lodged in a radiator, missing Porter by only a couple of feet. Chase ran. The cops shot him once from the back, then chased him into the living room and shot him again. Calvo was turned around and put on his knees in front of the door the police had just smashed to pieces. He heard them rummaging through his house, tossing drawers, emptying cabinets. Calvo and Porter were held for 4 hours. Calvo asked to see a search warrant. He was told it was en route. The police continued to search the house. At one point, a detective got excited when she found an envelope stuffed with cash. According to Porter, the detective was deflated when she found only $68 inside and noticed that the front of the envelope read, "Yard sale." At one point, Porter overheard a detective call to ask a relative to schedule a veterinary appointment. The sight of the dogs' bodies apparently reminded her that she needed to make an appointment for her own pet. Even after they realized they had just mistakenly raided the mayor's house, the officers didn't apologize to Calvo or Porter. Instead, they told Calvo that they were both parties of interest and that they should consider themselves lucky they weren't arrested. Calvo, in particular, they said, was still under suspicion because when armed men blew open his door, killed his dogs, and pointed their guns at him and his mother-in-law, he hadn't responded in a typical manner. Trinity Tomsic came home about an hour later to find a blur of flashing police lights and a crowd gathering on her front lawn. She was told that her husband and mother were fine. Then she was told that her dogs were dead. She broke down in tears. When she was finally able to enter her home, she found her dog's blood all over her house. The police had walked through the two large pools of blood that collected under Peyton and Chase, then tracked it all over the home. Even once the police realized they had made a mistake, they never offered to clean up the blood, to put the house back together, or to fix the front door. As Calvo and Porter were being interrogated, one of Calvo's own police officers saw the lights and stopped to see what was going on. Berwyn Heights officer Amir Johnson knew this was his mayor's house, but had no idea what the commotion was about, because the Prince George's County Police Department hadn't bothered to contact the Berwyn Heights police chief, as they were required to do under a memorandum of understanding between the two agencies. Johnson told the Washington Post that an officer at the scene told him, "The guy in there is crazy. He says he is the mayor of Berwyn Heights." Johnson replied, "That is the mayor of Berwyn Heights." Johnson then called Berwyn Heights Police Chief Patrick Murphy. Eventually, Murphy was put in touch with the supervising officer, Detective Sergeant David Martini. Murphy recounted the conversation to the Post. "Martini tells me that when the SWAT team came to the door, the mayor met them at the door, opened it partially, saw who it was, and then tried to slam the door on them," Murphy recalled. And that at that point, Martini claimed, they had to force entry, the dogs took aggressive stances, and they were shot. If that indeed was what Martini told Murphy, he was either lying or repeating a lie told to him by one of his subordinates. There was never any further mention of Calvo shutting the door on the SWAT team, because it never happened. Calvo later had his dogs autopsied. The trajectories the bullets took through the dogs' bodies weren't consistent with the SWAT team's story. But the lies, obfuscations, and stonewalling were only beginning. The police department would first claim that they had obtained a no-knock warrant for the raid. They then backtracked and blamed Calvo's mother-in-law, arguing that when her scream blew their cover, they were no longer obligated to knock and announce themselves. This was an interesting theory, given that the knock and announce requirement by definition would have required them to blow their own cover. That's the point of the requirement. Major Mark McGaw, commander of the Prince George's County Narcotics Enforcement Division, claimed that the SWAT team couldn't have obtained a no-knock warrant if they had wanted to, because the state of Maryland doesn't allow them. This, too, was false. The state had passed a bill allowing for no-knock warrants in 2005. It's the sort of law that one would think would have a day-to-day impact on the drug unit of a police department that conducts several raids each week. Yet the head narcotics unit in Prince George's County was completely ignorant of it. 3 years later, McGaw would be promoted to Prince George's County Police Chief. The affidavit for the search warrant was prepared by Detective Sean Scarlatta. It is incredibly thin. In a few paragraphs, Scarlatta relates that he intercepted a FedEx package containing 32 pounds of marijuana at one of the company's warehouses. The package was addressed to Trinity Tomsic at her home address. A police officer, disguised as a delivery man, then took the package to Calvo's house, where it was accepted by Georgia Porter. There was also a one-paragraph description of Calvo's home. That's the only information in the warrant specific to Calvo and his family. The remainder of the six-page affidavit is a cut-and-paste recitation of Scarlatta's training, qualifications, and assumptions he felt he could make based on his experience as a narcotics officer. As Calvo described the warrant in an online chat, it talks about all the stuff a drug trafficker should have in his or her home, and then says something like, "Although we know that the police have no evidence of these things, they can be inferred from the very nature of the charge." It is circular reasoning that says, because we are suspicious of you, there must be evidence of your guilt. On August 7th, police arrested a FedEx driver and an accomplice and charged them with various crimes related to drug trafficking. Trinity Tomsic was never supposed to receive that package of marijuana. A drug distributor in Arizona had used her address to get the package into the general Prince George's County area, at which point an accomplice working for the delivery company was supposed to intercept it. The police had found several similar packages. Worse, county police knew this scheme was going on, and knew some packages had been delivered to residences unbeknownst to the people who lived in them. The Washington Post reported a couple of months later on cases in which innocent people had been arrested. Defense lawyers who practice in the county said authorities appear to arrest and charge anyone who picks up a package containing marijuana without conducting a further investigation, the Post reported. The more I think about that, the angrier I get, Calvo later told Post columnist Mark Fisher. They knew this scheme was going on, yet it never occurred to them from the moment they found out about that package that we were anything but drug dealers. Prince George's County Police Chief Melvin High still couldn't bring himself to rule out the Calvos as suspects, telling the Washington Post, "From all the indications at the moment, they had an unlikely involvement, but we don't want to draw that definite conclusion at the moment." 2 days later, after the raid had made national and international news, the Prince George's County Police Department finally cleared Shy Calvo and his family of any wrongdoing. They did it by way of a press release they put out at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, the time and day of the week when bad news is typically buried. It also happened to be the night of the opening ceremonies for the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. Perhaps even more baffling, officials continued to insist that the raid shouldn't have happened any other way. Even as they acknowledged that Calvo and his family were innocent, in the months and years following the raid, they would repeat again and again that not a single officer did anything wrong and that no one had any reason for remorse. In 2010, Sheriff Michael Jackson was asked during his campaign for Prince George's County Executive if he had any regrets about the raid. His response, "Quite frankly, we'd do it again, tonight." Even when Chief High called Calvo to tell him that he had been cleared of any criminal suspicion, High made sure to explicitly tell the mayor that the call should not be interpreted as an apology. The statements from county officials over the next several months were also astonishingly callous. A day after he called Calvo, High told the press that the raiding cops showed restraint and compassion, and insisted that they should be credited for not arresting Calvo or members of his family. The only incriminating evidence found in the home was the unopened box of marijuana that the deputies themselves had delivered. Months later, Prince George's County Executive Jack Johnson said something even more preposterous. He insisted that once Prince George's County police agencies had cleared themselves, that was the only apology necessary, and in fact, that they deserved praise for clearing Calvo's name after nearly killing him. "Well, I think in America that is the apology, when we're cleared," Johnson said. "At the end of the day, the investigation showed Calvo was not involved, and that's, you know, a pat on the back for everyone involved, I think." On September 8th, about 5 weeks after the raid, Sheriff Jackson's office announced that his internal investigation had cleared his deputies of any wrongdoing. Everything was done according to procedure. Or, as Jackson put it, the guys did what they were supposed to do. 9 months later, Jackson's office would conclude another investigation, again clearing his deputies. Neither outcome was surprising, given that Jackson had been defending his deputies since the night of the raid. It's probably also worth noting that the father of Detective Sean Scarlatta, the officer who initiated the investigation leading to the raid, was on the internal affairs team that conducted the investigations. The officials in Prince George's County, two of them elected, openly and without reservation stated that they had no problem with the collateral damage done to the Calvo family. It was part of the war against getting high, which even they had to know is a war that can't be won. They didn't even really think it was something to regret or learn from, or to try to avoid in the future. As Calvo himself pointed out on several occasions, this isn't a problem that can be laid at the feet of the police officers who raided his home. This problem can't be fixed by firing the police involved. This is a political problem. It's a policy problem. Calvo understood all of this almost immediately. Someone sent him a copy of Overkill, The Rise of Paramilitary Police Raids in America, the paper on police militarization I had written for the Cato Institute 2 years earlier. A policy wonk at heart, Calvo devoured the paper, reading it on his subway rides to and from work. Still traumatized from the raid, his wife didn't like the image on the cover, a close-up of a SWAT officer with his hand on a machine gun. Calvo then began reading up on the case law behind these raids. Within a few weeks, the charismatic, accessible, small-town mayor had become a compelling advocate for reform. I moderated a forum about the raid at the Cato Institute in September 2008. As Calvo spoke about what he had gone through, and particularly about his dogs, and how angry he was that the police tried to blame the dogs for their own deaths, about a fourth of the audience was in tears. He told his story on CNN, the morning network talk shows, and the BBC. And to his credit, he recognized that what had specifically happened to him was part of a broader problem of policy, not of individual cops. The reality is that this happens all the time in this country, and disproportionately in Prince George's County, Calvo told CNN. Most of the people to whom it happens don't have the community support and the platform to speak out, so I appreciate you paying attention to our condition. But I hope you'll also give attention to those who may not have the same platform and voice that we have. As Calvo continued to advocate for reform, he started to hear from other victims of mistaken police raids, both in Prince George's County and around the state of Maryland. Several included the routine, sometimes callous, killing of the family dog. Within a week of the raid, for example, Prince George's County residents Frank and Pam Myers came forward to say that they too were raided by Sheriff's Department deputies. Indeed, that raid the previous November had been covered by some local media. When the couple told the deputies that the address on the warrant was two doors down, the police refused to leave. They continued to look around the couple's house for another 45 minutes. Then two shots rang out from the backyard. A deputy had gone into the backyard and shot the couple's 5-year-old boxer, Pearl. He claimed that he feared for his life. Pam Myers told a local news station, "I said, 'You just shot my dog. I just wanted to go out and hold her a bit. They wouldn't even let me go out.'" Amber James, another Prince George's County resident, also came forward. Police raided her home in May 2007, looking for her sister, who didn't live in the house. According to James, when their search came up empty, they promised to return the next day, and to kill James's dog when they did. A series of police raid horror stories from Howard County, Maryland, also emerged. Kevin and Lisa Henderson said they were the victims of a mistaken raid in January 2008. At 10 p.m. the night of January 18th, a raid team opened the family's unlocked front door. Inside were the couple, a 28-year-old house guest, their two teenage sons, and their son's friend. The police first met the family dog, a 12-year-old lab Rottweiler mix named Grunt. According to the lawsuit, one officer distracted the dog while another shot it point-blank in the head. When one of the couple's sons asked why they had shot the dog, one officer pointed his gun at the boy's head and said, "I'll blow your fucking head off if you keep talking." The police found marijuana in a jacket pocket of the Hendersons' house guest. He was arrested. 4 days later, after Lisa Henderson called to complain about the raid, she and her husband were also arrested for possession of marijuana, even though the police hadn't found any drug anywhere else in the house. 10 months later, a state judge acquitted the couple of all charges. The Hendersons believe that the police intended to raid a different house in the neighborhood that looked a lot like their own. A subsequent raid on that house turned up marijuana, scales, and cash. Karen Thomas, also a resident of Howard County, told a Maryland State Senate hearing in 2009 that police shot and killed her dog during a mistaken raid on her home in January 2007. Even after they had surrounded her in her bedroom, she said they still hadn't yet identified themselves, and she thought the gunshot had been directed at her son. "In my mind, terrorists had just killed my son, and they were going to kill me next." Boyd Pettit told the same committee, "Our collective lives flashed before our eyes during a mistaken raid on him and his family in April 2008. Mike Hassinai and his wife and their 12-year-old daughter were subjected to a nighttime raid when police received a tip that Hassinai's stepson and a friend might have stolen items from a police car, including a rifle and ammunition. They also raided the home where the stepson actually lived, as well as the friend's home. They found none of the stolen items and made no arrests. Hassinai and his wife, Phyllis, told the Baltimore Sun that they were still reeling from the trauma. They had their guns drawn. Angel and I were screaming, Phyllis Hassinai said. They had their black-on-black uniforms. All you could see were their eyeballs. Hassinai added that had police done a bit more investigating, they would have found out that neither of us are violent criminals. We don't have criminal records at all. Armed with these incidents, Calvo went to the Maryland legislature to push for reform. The bill he proposed was modest. It required every police agency in Maryland with a SWAT team to issue a quarterly report, later amended to twice yearly, on how many times the team was deployed, for what purpose, and whether any shots were fired during the raid. It was a simple transparency bill. It put no limits or restrictions on how often or under what circumstances SWAT teams could be used. Yet it was the only bill of its kind in the country, and it was opposed by every police organization in the state. One Maryland lawmaker attempted to amend the bill to prohibit the use of SWAT teams in cases involving known misdemeanors, a seemingly reasonable restriction. That measure was rejected after more lobbying from police groups. But the main bill passed the Maryland House in March 2009 by a vote of 126-9, and the state's Senate in April by a vote of 46-0. It was signed into law by Governor Martin O'Malley. Calvo sent the media a response to the legislation. Although the botched raid of my home and killing of our dogs, Peyton and Chase, have received considerable attention in the media, it is important to underscore that this bill is about much more than an isolated, high-profile mistake. It is about a growing and troubling trend where law enforcement agencies are using SWAT teams to perform ordinary police work. Prince George's County Police acknowledges deploying SWAT teams between 400 and 700 a year. That's twice a day. And other counties in the state have said that they also deploy their special tactical units hundreds of times a year. The hearings on these bills have brought to light numerous botched and ill-advised raids in Anne Arundel, Baltimore, Carroll, Howard, Montgomery, and Prince George's counties that also have had devastating effects on the lives of innocent people and undermined faith in law enforcement. Although I applaud lawmakers for passing this bill over the objections of law enforcement, I was disappointed that state law enforcement groups decided to oppose this measure rather than embrace it as an opportunity to restore the public trust. I remain especially concerned with the argument put forward that only law enforcement should police itself, and that it is somehow inappropriate for elected leaders to legislate oversight and accountability. I cannot disagree with this argument more. As elected officials, we must take full responsibility for the law enforcement departments that we fund and authorize, and we must hold our law enforcement officials to the highest standards and ideals. By the following spring, the Maryland Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention released the first batch of statistics. They were predictably unsettling. For the last half of 2009, SWAT teams were deployed 804 times in the state of Maryland, or about 4.5 times a day. In Prince George's County alone, which has about 850,000 residents, a SWAT team was deployed about once a day. According to an analysis by the Baltimore Sun, 94% of the state's SWAT deployments were to serve search or arrest warrants, leaving just 6% that were raids involving barricades, bank robberies, hostage takings, and other emergency situations. Half of Prince George's County's SWAT deployments were for what were called misdemeanors and non-serious felonies. More than 100 times over a six-month period, Prince George's County sent police barreling into private homes for non-serious, non-violent crimes. Calvo pointed out that the first set of figures confirm what he and others concerned about these tactics have suspected. SWAT teams are being deployed too often as the default way to serve search warrants, not as a last resort. In January 2011, Calvo settled his lawsuit with Prince George's County. Although the details haven't been made public, we know that it involved a substantial sum of money, as well as reforms to the way Prince George's County uses its SWAT teams, the types of cases in which the teams are deployed, and better training in dealing with the pets they encounter in raids, as well as treating them more humanely. How do we return to a more robust embrace of the Castle Doctrine, the Fourth Amendment, and an unbreachable divide between the police and the military? Overcoming a trend that has extended across two, possibly three generations sounds like an impossibly difficult task. And indeed, some of the people interviewed for this book are skeptical that it can be done. Donald Santarelli, the now regretful father of the no-knock raid, says, "I don't think it's possible to roll any of this back now. It would take serious leadership, probably from nobody less than the president. It would take a huge scandal, which doesn't seem likely. But we're not given to revolutionary action in this country. Each generation is a little more removed from the deep-seated concerns about liberty of the generation before. We just don't seem to value privacy and freedom anymore." Shai Calvo's example shows that change is possible, even though much more of it is in order. Despite falling crime rates, and even after the public outrage and media scrutiny engendered by the Calvo raid and other high-profile incidents, the number of SWAT raids continues to rise. Still, even if the will to bend the arc of police militarization doesn't currently exist, there are some policy reforms that would at least improve the current state of affairs. In particular, the concerned police officers and public officials interviewed for this book have suggested a number of possible reforms, some abstract, some concrete, some within reach, and some that, at least at the moment, seem unattainable. The drug war. To begin at the least likely end of the spectrum, the best reform to scale back the overly militarized, dangerously civil liberties-averse style of policing that prevails in this country would be to end the drug war altogether. Complete legalization is, of course, never going to happen. But even something short of legalization, like decriminalization, would remove many of the reasons why we're fighting the drug war as if it were an actual war. President Obama's drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, at least seemed to understand the value of rhetoric when he made a point in 2010 of stating that he didn't think it was appropriate to use the phrase drug war. Unfortunately, he didn't change any of the actual tactics used to enforce the federal drug laws. As indicated earlier, the raids, grants, and giveaways of Pentagon gear have all only increased since Obama took office. But just ending the federal drug war and the federal incentives toward militarization would help. SWAT teams would probably continue to exist, and, at least in the short term, would find other, probably equally objectionable missions. But ending the federal drug war could begin to unwind the violent paramilitary task forces and the us-versus-them black-and-white drug war mentality. If the federal government were to end the burn grants, cut off federal funding tied to drug enforcement, end the Pentagon giveaway program, and get rid of the federal equitable sharing program that lets local police departments get around state asset forfeiture laws and makes drug warring more lucrative and therefore a higher priority, we'd see more of these tactical teams begin to disband because of the expense of maintaining them. We'd almost certainly see the multi-jurisdictional task forces start to dry up, since they're often funded exclusively through federal grants and forfeiture. Those tactical teams that remained would no longer be incentivized to go on drug raids. Perhaps some still would. But without the money to lure them, it seems likely that the expense of deploying them would persuade police departments to reserve them for the sorts of missions for which they were originally intended. At the very least, the federal government should respect the states that have already expressed a desire to ease up on the drug war and stop sending in heavily armed battle teams to raid medical marijuana dispensaries and growers who are licensed and regulated under state law. Legislatures or city councils could also pass laws restricting the use of SWAT teams to those limited, rare emergencies in which there's an imminent threat to public safety. They could prohibit the use of no-knock raids or even forced entry to serve warrants on people suspected of violent crimes. Failing that, policymakers could simply put more restrictions on search warrants. For example, they could prohibit the use of dynamic entry tactics for any warrant obtained with only the word of an informant. The records of informants should be made available to defense attorneys and attorneys in civil suits, with the stipulation that any identifying information be redacted. Informants' records could simply be a set of numbers indicating their success rate. Ending any of the federal drug war policies that set all of this in motion would be a step in the right direction. Halt the mission creep. There is no need for regulatory agencies at any level to be conducting SWAT raids. The Department of Education and the Food and Drug Administration don't need their own SWAT teams. SWAT teams shouldn't be raiding American Legion halls to break up charity poker games. They shouldn't be raiding any poker games. Nor should they be used to confront Tibetan monks who have overstayed their visas, or sent to storm the offices of doctors suspected of overprescribing painkillers. And the idea of SWAT teams enforcing underage drinking laws, performing occupational licensing inspections, or checking that beer bottles are adequately labeled ought to be so self-evidently preposterous as to be laughable. That heavily armed assault forces are sent to perform such tasks ought to shock the conscience. The people making these kinds of decisions should lose their jobs. More broadly, the amount of force the government uses to enforce a given law should be based on a reasonable assessment of the threat posed by the person suspected of committing the crime, not by what sort of message the government wants to send about how seriously it takes whatever crime it happens to be enforcing. Transparency. Shai Calvo's bill in Maryland is a good start toward greater transparency. Other states should duplicate it. But there are other policies that would make police departments more transparent and less isolated and detached from their communities. The remarkable advances in and democratization of smartphone technology have enabled a large and growing portion of the population to record the actions of on-duty police officers. Rather than fighting it, police officials and policymakers ought to embrace this development. Legislatures should pass laws that not only clearly establish a citizen's right to record on-duty cops, but provide an enforcement mechanism so that citizens wrongly and illegally arrested have a course of action. As even many police officials have pointed out, such policies not only expose police misconduct, leading to improvements, but can also provide exonerating evidence in cases where police officers have been wrongly accused. All forced entry police raids should be recorded in a tamper-proof format, and the videos should be made available to the public through a simple open records request. If the political will to do so existed, this could be done efficiently and inexpensively. Even better, equip the officers participating in a raid with cameras mounted on their helmets, jackets, or guns. Not only would recording all raids help clear up disputes about how long police waited after knocking, whether police knocked at all, or who fired first. But the knowledge that every raid would be recorded would also encourage best practices among the SWAT teams. Additionally, recordings of raids would provide an accurate portrayal of how drug laws are actually enforced. It's likely that many Americans aren't fully aware of just how violent these tactics can be. Perhaps many would still support tactical raids for drug warrants even after being exposed to videos of actual drug raids. But if the drug war is being waged to protect the public should be able to see exactly how the war is being waged. Police departments should track warrants from the time they're obtained to the time they're executed in a database that's accessible to civilian review boards, defense attorneys, judges, and, in some cases, the media, acknowledging that the identities of confidential informants need not be revealed. Botched raids should be documented, including warrants served on the wrong address, warrants based on bad tips from informants, and/or warrants that resulted in the death or injury of an officer, a suspect, or a bystander. Police departments should also keep running tabs of how many warrants are executed with no-knock entry versus knock-and-announce entry, how many required a forced entry, how many required the deployment of a SWAT team or other paramilitary unit, and how many used diversionary devices like flashbang grenades. They should also make records of what these raids turned up. If these tactics are going to be used against the public at the very least deserves to know how often they're used, why they're used, how often things go wrong, and what sort of results the tactics are getting. Local police departments that receive federal funding should also be required to keep records on and report incidents of officer shootings and use of excessive force to an independent federal agency, such as the National Institute for Justice or the Office of the Inspector General. We also need easy-to-find, publicly accessible records of judges and search warrants, and where applicable, prosecutors. The public deserves to know if all the narcotics cops in a given area are going to the same judge or magistrate with their narcotics warrants, or if a given judge hasn't declined a warrant in 20 years. As more and more courts use computer software to process warrants, it will get easier to compile this sort of information and make it available to the public. Community policing. Police departments and policymakers should embrace real community policing. That doesn't mean sending off millions of dollars in federal grants that merely say community policing on the envelope. Nor does it mean calling the deployment of SWAT teams to clear out entire neighborhoods community policing, because such actions involve both police and a community. Instead, it means taking cops out of patrol cars to walk beats and become a part of the communities they serve. It means ditching statistics-driven policing, which encourages the sorts of petty arrests of low-level offenders and use of informants that foment anger and distrust. The emphasis on statistics in the war on drugs is really what encourages the Fourth Amendment cheating, says Stephen Downing, the former deputy chief at the LAPD. Everyone wants to be successful at what they do. Police officers are no different. But we have this drug war, and in order to get the goods, the grants and such, which earn you good reviews and promotions, you have to meet your quotas. So you want to get in before the drugs are flushed down the toilet. So you lie about what goes on at the door. You take shortcuts to get your warrant before the drugs are moved. It's the bad policy that forces that to happen. The big shots will say to the public, "We have all these rules and we enforce them. There are no quotas." But then, internally, they'll say, "Why do you only have 2 arrests this month?" It's a system that creates cheaters. The quota system just doesn't work without cheating. Changing police culture. Changing a culture sounds like a tall order, and it probably is. I think there are 2 critical components to policing that cops today have forgotten, says the former Maryland cop Neil Franklin. Number 1, you've signed on to a dangerous job. That means that you've agreed to a certain amount of risk. You don't get to start stepping on others' rights to minimize that risk you agreed to take on. And number 2, your first priority is not to protect yourself. It's to protect those you've sworn to protect. But I don't know how you get police officers today to value those principles again. The us and everybody else sentiment is strong today. It's very, very difficult to change a culture. But high-ranking police officials and the policymakers who oversee them could start by simply not perpetuating the problem. Consider those recruitment videos discussed previously. Think back to high school or college and consider who among your classmates would have been excited by that sort of video. Now think about who among your classmates would have been attracted to a video depicting cops walking a beat, attending meetings of neighborhood groups, or learning the skills necessary to de-escalate a potentially dangerous situation instead of shooting the problem away. These are 2 very different personality types. It's really about a lack of imagination and a lack of creativity, says Norm Stamper. When your answer to every problem is more force, it shows that you haven't been taught and trained to consider other options. The thing is, when law enforcement officials face suspects who present a genuine threat to officer safety, they do tend to be more creative. When the FBI finally located Whitey Bulger in 2010, after searching for him for 16 years, the reputed mobster was suspected in nearly 20 murders and was thought to be armed with a huge arsenal of weapons. Of all the people who might meet the criteria for arrest by a SWAT team, you'd think Bulger would top the list. He was also aging, in poor physical health, and looking at spending the rest of his life in prison. If ever there was a candidate to go out in a blaze of cop-killing glory, it was Whitey Bulger. And yet, instead of sending a tactical team in to tear down Bulger's door, the FBI did some investigating and learned that Bulger rented a public storage locker. They called him up, pretending to be from the company that owned the facility, and told Bulger someone might have broken into his locker. When he went to the facility to investigate, he was arrested without incident. Why can't investigators handle common drug offenders the same way? A big reason is a lack of resources. If your department is serving several drug warrants a day, you just aren't going to have the personnel to come up with that sort of plan for each one. A second reason is that drug offenders simply aren't all that likely to shoot at cops, and it's easier to use violent tactics against people who aren't going to fire back. It's by no means a universal rule, but often when police do face a genuinely violent suspect, like an escaped fugitive with a violent history, a suspect in a series of violent crimes, or a barricade or hostage situation, they don't immediately storm the place. They set up a perimeter or try to figure out other ways to make the arrest safely. This, again, isn't possible with drug warrants. There are just too many of them. But because drug dealers aren't all that dangerous, it works out to raid them instead. Police today are also given too little training in counseling and dispute resolution, and what little training they do get in the academy is quickly blotted out by what they learn on the street in the first few months on the job. When you're given an excess of training in the use of force, but little in using psychology, body language, and other non-coercive means of resolving a conflict, you'll naturally gravitate toward force. I think about the notion of command presence, Stamper says. When you as a police officer show up at a chaotic or threatening or dangerous situation, you need to demonstrate your command presence, that you are the person in command of this situation. You do this with your bearing, your body language, and your voice. What I see today is that this well-disciplined notion of command presence has been shattered. Cops today think you show command presence by yelling and screaming. In my day, if you screamed, if you went to a screaming, out-of-control presence, you had failed in that situation as a cop. You'd be pulled aside by a senior cop or sergeant and made to understand in no uncertain terms that you were out of line. The very best cops I ever worked around were quiet, which isn't to say they were withdrawn or passive, but they were quiet. They understood the value of silence, the powerful effect of a pause. Stamper adds that these things aren't emphasized anymore. Verbal persuasion is the first tool a police officer has. The more effective he or she is as a communicator, the less likely it is he or she is going to get impulsive or need to. Neil Franklin suggests that deteriorating physical fitness at police departments can also lead to unnecessary escalations of force, another argument in favor of foot patrols over car patrols. When I was commander of training in Baltimore, one of the first things I did was evaluate the physical condition of the police officers themselves, Franklin said. The overweight guys were the guys who knew very little about arrest control and defensive strategy. Being a police officer is a physically demanding job. You can't be so out of shape. When you are, you're less confident about less lethal force. It can get so that the only use of force you're capable of using is a firearm. You also fear physical confrontation, so you're more likely to reach for your firearm earlier. Getting cops in shape is a confidence builder, and it gets people away from relying too much on the weapons they have on their belt. More generally, politicians should also be held accountable when they use war rhetoric to discuss crime and illicit drugs. Words do have an impact on the way police officers approach their jobs, and the way they view the people with whom they interact while on patrol. If we want to dissuade them from seeing their fellow citizens as the enemy, we need to stop our political leaders, the people who set the policies and appropriate the budgets for those officers, from referring to their fellow citizens as the enemy. Accountability. In numerous states across the country, police unions have lobbied legislatures to pass variations on a Law Enforcement Bill of Rights. Though they vary from state to state, The general thrust of these laws is to afford police officers accused of crimes additional rights above and beyond what regular citizens get. Or, as Reason Magazine's Mike Riggs puts it, the intent of such laws is to shield cops from the laws they're paid to enforce. These laws have made it nearly impossible to fire bad cops in many jurisdictions. And worse, they have instilled in them the notion that they're above the law and above the regular citizens they're supposed to serve. Investigations of how bad cops are able to stay on the job have become a perennial newspaper undertaking. Recent exposés have tackled the flawed systems in Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, West Virginia, and Chicago. Part of the problem is that union management negotiations in law enforcement are decidedly different from those in the private sector. For one, there's little downside for a mayor or city council to give everything away. Voters rarely get angry at politicians for being too generous with the police. But when city officials face tight budgets, they can use accountability as a negotiating chip, offering more job protections for cops accused of wrongdoing in exchange for concessions on pay or benefits. A CEO who negotiates away his ability to hold his employees accountable is likely to feel the repercussions on his bottom line. It affects him directly. When city officials make it more difficult to fire bad cops, they are rarely affected that way. At worst, a lawsuit might take a bite out of a city budget. But no cops will be harassing or beating the politicians themselves. That happens to other people. Police unions also help enforce the Blue Code of Silence, the unwritten rule that police officers never rat out or testify against other police officers. A stark example from several years ago in New Mexico involved, oddly enough, former race car driver Al Unser Sr. In 2006, Albuquerque police officer Sam Costales testified against some deputies from the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department. The deputies had gotten into a confrontation with Unser that resulted in Unser's arrest and criminal charges. Costales had witnessed the incident. At Unser's trial, he testified that Unser did not assault or threaten officers from the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department, as claimed in police reports. Costales' testimony helped Unser win an acquittal. None of the Bernalillo deputies was disciplined, but one officer was, Sam Costales. His own chief opened an internal affairs investigation of him. Costales' transgression, he wore his police uniform when he testified in Unser's case. Albuquerque cops apparently are permitted to wear the uniform when they're testifying for the prosecution, but not when they're testifying for the defense. At that point, the Albuquerque Police Union got involved, but not to protect Officer Costales. He may have been disciplined for telling the truth, but for the union, he committed the far more serious offense of telling an unflattering truth about his fellow cops. James Badway, secretary of the Albuquerque Police Officers Association, apologized for Costales' actions in an email message to the Bernalillo sheriff. As secretary of the APOA, I feel it is my duty and responsibility to apologize to you and your officers. Officer Sam Costales does not represent APD, APOA. The majority of our officers look at the BCSO as our brother and sisters in blue. We are embarrassed and ashamed of Officer Costales' testimony in the Unser trial. If there is anything we can do to rebuild the damage caused by Sam, please let me know. Only in law enforcement would a union rep apologize to the management for the actions of one of its members. Former narcotics cop Russ Jones says that unions reinforce the notion among cops that it's just them and their brother cops against the world. Police unions have really gotten to the point where they protect bad police officers, and they shield management from having to take any responsibility, Jones says. Everybody involved in the bargaining wins. The citizens end up the losers, in all aspects. Perhaps the biggest problem with police unions, however, is that they present a major obstacle to real reform. Their political clout is difficult to surmount. Democrats don't cross them because of the traditional alliance of unions and public employees. Republicans rarely cross them because of the party's law and order reputation. But awareness of their formidable influence and likely opposition to any accountability efforts is at least a start. Good ideas for accountability policies include civilian review boards, but only if they have subpoena power, are granted the authority to impose discipline and can't be overruled by arbitrators. Unfortunately, there aren't many in the country that have those powers. And as we saw with the death of Alberta Spruill and other cases, even a major headline-grabbing scandal isn't enough to establish credible civilian oversight. The most productive accountability policy, and thus the most controversial and least likely to be adopted, would be to impose more liability on police officers who make egregious errors. Under the qualified immunity from civil lawsuits currently afforded to police under federal law, a police officer can't be sued for mere negligence, or even for gross negligence that results in a fatality. To even get into court against a police officer, a plaintiff must show not only that a police officer intentionally violated the plaintiff's constitutional rights, but that said rights were well established at the time they were violated. With this protection, police officers aren't required to keep informed on the latest court decisions that pertain to their job. In fact, in a perverse way, it even discourages police departments and officers from doing so. A cop who is aware that he was violating someone's rights is much more likely to be found liable than a cop who isn't. Some commentators, like University of Tennessee law professor Glenn Reynolds, have suggested that SWAT teams that conduct forced entry raids be held to a strict liability standard. If they raid the wrong house, they're liable for damages, no matter what, whether the mistake was due to a bad informant, a mistyped address, or just a bad investigation, wouldn't matter. Such a policy would be difficult to apply in many cases. For example, if police claim in the affidavit that they're looking for a large stash of heroin, but raid a house that turns up only a small amount of pot, would that be considered a wrong house raid? Still, adopting the policy just for cases of clear, unambiguous mistakes would probably encourage more caution, more restraint, and fewer errors. The most difficult change is the one that's probably necessary to make any of these others happen. The public needs to start caring about these issues. The proliferation of cop watch sites, citizen shot video of police misconduct, and coverage of police abuse incidents by a bevy of online media is encouraging. Another good sign is the fact that this growing skepticism of police has been accompanied by a decline in violence against police officers themselves. Activists are fighting police abuse with technology and information, not with threats and violence. But while exposing individual incidents of misconduct is important, particularly to the victim of the misconduct, it's more important to expose the policies that allow misconduct to flourish. Bad systems will continue to turn out bad results, and bad systems will never be reformed until and unless policymakers and politicians, A, are convinced there is a problem, and B, pay a political price for not addressing it. Yes, trends that develop over years or decades can gradually normalize things that we might not have tolerated had they been imposed on us all at once. But it's still rather remarkable that domestic police officers are driving tanks and armored personnel carriers on American streets, breaking into homes and killing dogs over pot. They're subjecting homes and businesses to commando raids for white-collar and even regulatory offenses. And there's been barely any opposition or concern from anyone in Congress, any governor, or any mayor of a sizable city. That, more than anything, is what needs to change. Conclusion. The war on drugs, I liken it to the Vietnam War. Hit and miss. There is no clear win. We don't know if we're gaining ground or not. What we want to do is, we want to change our strategy. We want to make this more like a Normandy invasion. Former Clayton County, Georgia Sheriff Victor Hill. The way these people were treated has to be judged in the context of a war. Hallandale, Florida attorney Richard Kane, after city police mistakenly raided Edwin and Catherine Bernhardt. I have my own army in the NYPD, the 7th largest army in the world. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Officers' safety comes first, and not infringing on people's rights comes second. Philadelphia Police Department spokesperson Fran Healy. My message to my troops is, if you see anybody carrying a gun on the streets of Milwaukee, we'll put them on the ground, take the gun away, and then decide whether you have a right to carry it. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, describing how his officers would harass legal gun owners in spite of Wisconsin state law. Given that the founders could never have anticipated police as they exist today, maybe are cops constitutional is the wrong question. A better one might be, are today's police forces consistent with the principles of a free society? It's difficult to say that they are. Police today are armed, dressed, trained, and conditioned like soldiers. They're given greater protections from civil and criminal liability than normal citizens. They're permitted to violently break into homes, often at night, to enforce laws against nonviolent, consensual acts. And even then, often on rather flimsy evidence of wrongdoing. Negligence and errors in judgment that result in needless terror, injury, and death are rarely held accountable. Citizens who make similar errors under the same circumstances almost always face criminal charges, usually felonies. Police today share a bond tighter than that shared by soldiers who fight in wars together. There's a strict code of omerta that's enforced more ruthlessly and thoroughly than in any other non-criminal profession. Cops who rat out other cops tend not to remain cops for very long. Lying and exaggerating in police reports and on the witness stand isn't just common. It's routine and expected. It's a part of the job. Today, there are entire communities in which a large percentage of residents refuse to talk to police under any circumstances. These so-called stop snitching movements are often derided by politicians and police officials, but there's a pretty astonishing revelation driving them. There are large swaths of the population who fear the people who are supposed to protect them from criminals more than they fear the criminals. As I've written and spoken on this issue over the years, I've even had current and former members of the military tell me they object to the word militarization, not because they disagree with the basic premise of what's happened to police departments in recent years, but because, from their own experience, the military is more accountable and disciplined than many police departments today. Several have even told me that military raids on residences where they suspected insurgents may be hiding are done more carefully and with more deference to the rights of potential innocents than some of the SWAT raids they see and read about today. The police today may be more militarized than the military. Police officers today are a protected class, one no politician wants to oppose. Law enforcement interests may occasionally come up short on budgetary issues, but legislatures rarely, if ever, pass new laws to hold police more accountable, to restrict their powers, or to make them more transparent. In short, police today embody all of the threats the founders feared were posed by standing armies, plus a few additional ones they couldn't have anticipated. This isn't to say we're in a police state, a term that's often misused. Generally speaking, we're free to travel. We don't face mass censorship. We still have habeas corpus. And the odds of any single person being victimized by a wrong-door raid, shot or beaten by a cop, or otherwise victimized by militarized police violence are slim to nil. But perhaps we have entered a police state writ small. At the individual level, a police officer's power and authority over the people he interacts with day to day is near complete. Absent video, if the officer's account of an incident differs from that of a citizen, even several citizens, his superiors, the courts, and prosecutors will nearly always defer to the officer. If other officers are nearby, there are policies in place, official and unofficial, to encourage them to back one another up. Even if the officer does violate the citizen's rights, the officer is protected by qualified immunity. In the introduction, I noted that this is not an anti-cop book, and it isn't. Despite all of this, there are still good cops, a lot of them. But we have passed laws and policies that have elevated police officers above the people they serve. As Tim Lynch of the Cato Institute has written, you could make a good argument that police should be held to a higher standard than regular citizens. And you could make a good argument they should be held to the same standard. But it's hard to conceive of a convincing argument that they should be held to a lower one. But that's exactly what we've done. Systems governed by bad policies and motivated by incentives will produce bad outcomes. Today, laws, policies, and procedures select for personalities attracted to aggressive, antagonistic policing, isolate police from the communities they serve, and condition police officers to see the people they serve, the people with whom they interact every day, as the enemy. We shouldn't then be surprised when cops then begin to see a world divided between cops and their families and everybody else. Perhaps most distressing of all, not only does the military continue to provide surplus weapons to domestic police agencies, but thanks to the Department of Homeland Security grants, military contractors are now shifting to market resources toward police agencies. Worse, a new industry appears to be emerging just to convert those grants into battle-grade gear. That means we'll soon have powerful private interests funded by government grants who will lobby for more government grants to pay for further militarization. A police-industrial complex. It's a threshold that will be difficult to uncross. No, America today isn't a police state. Far from it. But it would be foolish to wait until it becomes one to get concerned. This concludes the reading of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces by Radley Balko. Copyright 2013 by Radley Balko. This book was read by William Hughes. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Public Affairs, a member of the Perseus Books Group, and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.